Welcome to the Dirt on the Past,
the Museum Edition,
a YouTube and podcast program of the Extreme History Project, which explores ancient and historical topics relating to artifact collections from the Museum of the Rockies right here in Bozeman, Montana.
At Extreme History, we explore the good, the bad, and the ugly about our human past because, let's face it, history isn't pretty. But it's so important to know because it's at the very thing that has led us to the most critical concerns in the present.
So join me, Nancy Mahoney.
And me, Crystal Alegria.
As we talk to archaeologists and historians who have been digging in the dirt.
And in the archives.
And in museum collections to uncover fascinating histories that are relevant to today's issues.
And can help us move forward with a deeper understanding of the past.
Hi, everyone. I'm Nancy.
And I'm Crystal.
And this is Sophie. And welcome to this week's edition of the show. We're the co-hosts of The Dirt on the Past. And we're here at the Museum of the Rockies E.L. Wiegand Digital Learning Studio. And we are... have been collaborating with the Museum of the Rockies, most of you know, with our podcast. So you can still listen to it the usual way on any podcast platform. And you can watch us if you want to see us and sometimes the artifacts that we have and some slides and photos and things. You can look us up on YouTube or on Facebook. Just put in The Dirt on the Past and you'll be able to find us. But today... it's just Crystal and me, and we're kind of excited to have this. Well, and Sophie.
And Ashley.
Of course, she's always doing the work. Sophie has been being photographed by Ashley. She's having a little photo shoot. Oh, there we go. And I think you're going to have a new best friend
before
the end of this. I know. So today, we're excited to talk to you about one of the oldest sites in Montana. It's a Paleo-Indian era site that not a lot of people know that much about. And it's not your typical Paleo-Indian site. So it's called Barton Gulch, and it is a site not only in Montana, but the collections are here at the Museum of the Rockies. And it was excavated by a former professor from Montana State University. So we'll get into all of that. But you know, Crystal, it has been a long time since we have just caught up.
I know.
So what has been going on in your world?
Okay, well, let's do catch up a little bit. So we were just talking before we got on the podcast today that this weekend I went to Pictograph Cave State Park, one of our favorite places, and a place that Nancy, you've done so much work on and so much research on. And so it was kind of a spur of the moment trip. My husband and I decided to go because our good friend Tim Urbaniak, who we've had on the podcast before. Shout out.
Another expert on Pictograph Cave.
Yeah. Yep. And he was doing a presentation there on his book, Men of the Cave. And that's what we talked to him about on the podcast. And so we just for the moment decided to up and go to Pictograph, and we had a beautiful drive there. Nice. And we hung out all day. We went to Tim's presentation, and then it was Earth Day, so we went to a lot of other presentations on all sorts of different topics that were happening. And our friend Mike Penfold, who does a lot of work on the Bozeman Trail, was there and did a presentation as well, and a few other people. So it was so nice to be back at Pictograph.
Kick off the spring season. And tell me what's going on with Extreme History.
Yeah, so Extreme History, we're gearing up for walking tours right now, and we have some other summer programming that's going to be really fun that we're working on. And we did our tour guide training this past weekend as well. And so that was really fun. And we have a great set of tour guides for this summer walking tours.
It looks like a nice picture of all your new guides outside.
Yeah.
So that's going to be a great season.
It's going to be really good. We're going to have a really good season. So we've been working on some of that stuff. And Extreme History has one of our biggest fundraisers of the year called Give Big Gallatin Valley that we participate in. Yay. And so we are gearing up for that too, which is on May 2nd and 3rd. And it's a two-day event, basically 24-hour event where we raise money for nonprofits all over Gallatin Valley here in Montana. But we raise money for Extreme History at that time. So if you love this podcast,
yes,
or some of the other things that we do, make sure to give big to history and give big to Extreme History.
And how can people find it, whether they're in Montana or not in Montana? How can they find where to donate?
So they just go to the Give Big Gallatin Valley website. If you Google that, you will find it. And then you just punch in Extreme History and you'll come to our page and you can donate from 6 p.m. on May 2nd to 6 p.m. on May 3rd.
And we should put a link. We will have a link also on the Dirt on the Past podcast. If we do another one, are we doing another one before May 3rd? Okay, so we'll put it on for this link.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we'll have that.
Yeah, and in association with that, we're doing some walking tours, some kind of special walking tours downtown through downtown Bozeman. So it'll be fun. So,
wonderful.
Yeah, that's so awesome. That's kind of what's happening with Extreme History.
Always
what
busy.
About,
yeah, Always busy.
What about you, Nancy?
Well, I've been teaching, coming to the end of the semester, teaching an Anthropology 101 class. Mm-hmm. And about 2 weeks ago, in collaboration with Museum of the Rockies and two comedians from Last Best, I participated in History is a Joke, which was the first time event where we were making fun, sort of bringing some real history and anthropology to the crowd, but also in a very fun format. So there were games, there were tours, there were discussions about things, and we had audience participation, but mostly there was just a lot of laughing and some learning. So it was fun for me.
It was
the first
great.
Time I've tried to keep up on stage with comedians, and that was quite a learning
you did really well. You did really well. But you also brought in some information about why people laugh, which was so interesting. And so
it's important. It Humans is. Are the only ones who do it.
Yeah,
so
I didn't
we
know
should
that.
Dive into that. I know.
So we learned a lot. We were in the crowd, Larry and I, my husband and I were there in the crowd, and it was so much fun to see the crowd enjoying history in that way, in such a different way, than
we
normal.
We were wondering if people would show up, and
they did.
So maybe paleontology is also a joke,
yeah.
And maybe archaeology is a joke,
yeah.
But we may see more of these popping up, so that sounds like fun.
It was very fun.
So I did that, and then I was excited because for an extra credit assignment for my class, I mentioned Dirt on the Past, and I said they could pick one of the episodes that's linked to something we've talked about in anthropology in the class, and they could do a summary, and I gave them very specific sort of guidelines to do a short paper. Yeah. And then I had one student come up to me after class just the other day and say that he listened to the podcast on the Hagen site because he's from Glendive.
His dad
listened to it too. They work in an area right adjacent to that property and know about it. So I said, if we come out to Glendive, could you show us around and things? And he said his dad knows a lot of stories. So I'm really excited that students are getting into it and diving into some of our podcasts. And I'm excited to see what they write about.
That's so exciting.
So more on that later.
Good. We'll see what they write about.
So it's been a really fun semester to kind of bring those two things together. Yeah. And then busy with the shop as well. But other than that, we did do a quick drive through West Yellowstone, and it was great. There were bison on the road.
Oh, nice.
And their coats looked beautiful and furry, kind of the real puffy winter coats still,
but you could
see their ribs. These guys were all hungry, and they were just eating everything along the road. And it was just fun as usual to get that close to them. And then we did get to see a lot of elk, and then we did some bird watching. My husband knows that Ennis Lake is a good place, and we were treated to thousands of birds that were migrating through. So it was pretty
wonderful.
Awesome.
Well, that's great. Well, it sounds like good things, all good things.
Yes, it was a sunny day, and we're like, we have to take advantage of it. So we
great.
Got out there.
Good.
All right. So,
well, I'm super excited to talk about the Barton Gulch site today. And the Barton Gulch site is really considered to be a late Paleo-Indian age site. And we'll talk about what that means in numbers here in a minute. But that really means that it's more of a recent site than Clovis or Folsom, like we've talked about with some of the other sites, like the Anzac site. And so it's more recent, but it is still a very old site. So it's really unique. It's a very unique site.
It's unusual for the Montana period and for anywhere.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And also, like Nancy, you said before, it's one that not a lot of folks know about. So it's a hugely significant site, but not a lot of people know about it. So that is one of the reasons we really wanted to talk about it today, because it is so important. And if you study anthropology, you learn about it. But other than that, there's not a lot out there on it. So we wanted to talk about it today also because the Museum of the Rockies has a lot of the artifacts that were excavated from this archaeological site. So they are housed here. But Nancy, can you start off by giving us a bit of background on the Barton Gulch site?
Yeah, this was fun to dive back into and brush up on again. And I expect, hopefully, there might be more reports, more information forthcoming. And maybe somewhere down the line, there might even be a way to create an exhibit that gets a chance to show that off. But we'll talk a little bit more about the interesting collaborations that would have to entail. So yeah. Barton Gulch is located along the Ruby River. So it's just south of Virginia City, Montana, not too far from where we are. Yeah. And the site dates to about 9,500 years ago. So that would translate into about 7,500 BC. So that's really old. That's quite old. But as we were talking about, the Anzac site is about 2,000 years older than that.
Yeah.
So we know we've had people in Montana 12 to 13,000 years ago. But I just want to also get this in there because we did do a podcast with the lead author, the team that found those footprints in New Mexico, in White Sands, New Mexico, along the lake. And they just recently did a whole new series of dates because the first round of dates came back that those footprints were 21,000 years old, which is some of the oldest dates we have for human occupation in North America. There's only one other site I know of in South America that's a bit controversial that might date older than that. Mm-hmm. So they redated with radiocarbon dating both pollen grains and some more seeds, and the dates came back the same. Now it's between 21 and 23,000 years old. So, and they're not even on the coast, right? They didn't just kind of, they're inland. So, so we definitely had people
coming through
in
this
North America and here 20,000 years ago and probably a lot older. So so that's interesting. But at this point, this site is one of the oldest ones we have in Montana. It's probably the third or fourth oldest site that's been excavated. And it was excavated by Dr. Les Davis, who was an archaeologist, taught anthropology here at Montana State University. And he was very interested in finding evidence of sort of these earliest inhabitants of the Americas. And that was one of his goals through his research, though he did excavate from a lot of different time periods. But what's so fascinating about Barton Gulch and the way it's so different from other Paleo-Indian sites is that it's not a bison kill site. In fact, there are no bison at this site. And especially in this later part of the Paleo-Indian period, which starts 13,000 years ago with Clovis points, which we'll talk about in just a second, it's unusual. We haven't found or been able to locate sites that aren't part of bison kills. I think in some part, they're a little bit easier to find on the landscape and the bones preserve well, and then those larger Paleo-Indian points preserve well. Yeah. So this is actually a site where people were making charcoal and cooking plants that they had gathered. So they had different kinds of basin hearths and ovens that they were using at the site. So they had a broader range of food. It really changed, and it was excavated in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And it was really one of the first windows we had into what else people were eating besides meat.
Right. Because, a lot of times we focus in on these bison kill sites or pronghorn antelope kill sites, all these really heavy duty meat sites. And so that's another reason I love this site, is because it really focuses in on some other food groups that, of course, people were eating and using.
We know they had to be. It was sort of a similar story, I think we'd always hear about Neanderthals, that they were big game hunters, meat eaters, because again, those were the easiest things to find, the obvious things. And it wasn't until a lot more research was done and that we could get new information from bones and teeth to realize, oh no, they had a much broader diet, which makes sense from everything we know about hunter-gatherers, from foragers. Meat is a component of the diet. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have a lot of strictly vegetarian foragers out there. There's always fish or meat protein in there. Yeah. And but plant foods make up the bulk of the calories.
Right.
Absolutely. Right. So this is very unusual. And I think because there haven't been so many other sites found like this, mm-hmm. it kind of was like a one and done almost, sort of made its splash. And after the early 1990s, I don't feel like we've heard a lot about it.
Yeah.
You?
Yeah, no, I don't. And I think that there's still, like you said, at the beginning, a lot being written on it. So we will probably hear more about it as time goes on, but it's exciting to talk about. And I just want to ask you, Nancy, I'm wondering how they found this site,
right?
Because it, like you said, it was in the Ruby Valley, the Ruby River Valley, which is near Virginia City. And Virginia City was one of our gold rush towns. So
absolutely.
In the 1860s, 1863, gold was found in Virginia City. And people went crazy. So many hundreds of people came, thousands of people came out to what we now call Montana and started looking for gold.
There wasn't that many people coming here
until then. There had been people, of course, living here for thousands of years,
but
this was a huge migration coming. So people were looking for gold and they left no stone unturned. And so when you go today to Virginia City, you see these huge mounds of this, all the rock and all the disturbance of this ground, because they did so much damage to the environment looking for gold. And so it is amazing to me that this archaeological site is still intact. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Right, and I got curious about that too, trying to figure out how did they find it and was it damaged by earlier mining excavations and things like that. And it turns out, I guess, just this terrace just up from the Ruby River, there were some garnet miners, but they were going along the riverbank and I think some artifacts had washed out and they looked fairly old to them. They were these larger points. So they contacted Tom Roll, who was also an anthropologist. Did you take classes with him?
Tom Roll was one of my main anthropology professors when I was in the MSU, Montana State University Anthropology Department in my undergraduate degree. And so I took a lot of classes from Dr. Tom Roll, and I did a lot of excavation under Dr. Tom Roll. So he was one of my, he's the reason I know as much as I do about anthropology and archaeology is because of Dr. Roll.
I only met him a couple of times before he was emeritus or retired.
Yeah.
And I think Jack Fisher was also good friends with him. So he was here and someone notified him and I think he passed it on to Les Davis, and Les decided that later, this was early in the 80s. And so a couple of years later, I think there was funding that Les was able to secure to take people out into the field, also some students. And they did, I think, at least three or four seasons of excavation. And it was tricky. So they knew this is an old site. And I think from where they could figure that the artifacts were coming out of, they knew there was a huge amount of overburden.
Yeah.
So technically, when all is said and done, there was 24 vertical feet that they ultimately had to go down in some places to get to that oldest occupation, because there is one younger occupation above it that dates to about 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. And so they used heavy machinery to take off the top layers that didn't have any cultural material. So they weren't destroying any part of the site. And you have people who are very skilled with a backhoe and things like that. So they were able to scrape down some of that with machinery and then go in and excavate down.
Okay.
So it was undisturbed, which is remarkable because it allowed them to find so many interesting things.
I know. And probably because it was so far down, 24 feet down. And you wrote in our script here, that's two stories.
Two stories.
And that's what made me think, wow, that's crazy. That's crazy. Right, it's way down there.
Yeah. Get to find a site that's deeply buried, much less than be able to excavate it intact. Usually you find those sites because someone's digging a huge foundation and they've destroyed part of it, So this was a very fortuitous discovery.
Yeah. So people had lived in this place more than once. So we have the bottom layer that we're going to talk more about. But what about the more recent layer that you were telling us about?
The younger one dates between 4,000 and 2,000 years ago. So I think we're talking more of like a late archaic period. Okay. And this is really challenging my knowledge of the sequence here in Montana, which is not what I did most of my studies on in school. But that older layer is the one that really has provided unusual information for that time period. So that's the one we'll really talk about today. Okay. So they did collect and excavate the younger layer, and I believe those artifacts are also here. And we just want to say there has been a lot of analysis done, but there wasn't a final report or book that was able to be published before all the people that worked on the project had moved on or graduated, gotten jobs, and then eventually after he retired and passed away, he had been working on these things. So we're hopeful maybe this is a project for someone to come back to and bring together.
Graduate students out there, or anyone, or students in general, this is a great PhD dissertation just waiting for you, or master's thesis too.
Absolutely.
but this site also was it always interesting? Go ahead.
I was going to say, you've heard a lot about
it. Yeah, I've heard a lot about it. It's really interesting to me because when I was doing my undergraduate work in the early 90s, they were excavating this site. And I never participated in that excavation because I was doing
somewhere else, right?
Yeah, I worked at what is now called First People's Buffalo Jump, which at that time was called Alm Pishkin. And so I was doing all my work over there with Dr. Jack Fisher and Dr. Tom Roll. And so, but I always heard all my colleagues and friends were working on Barton Gulch site, and they were finding all this amazing information. All this amazing information was coming out, and it was new information about kind of these plant resources. And then Steve Auberg, who is a paleoethnobotanist, he also worked at First People's Buffalo Jump. So he was working at Barton Gulch at that same time.
Wow.
And so he was coming back and telling us the tales of what was being found at Barton Gulch. And
so what do you remember?
Remember that it was so fascinating, all the plant materials that were coming out. And they talked a lot about these features, which are kind of these groupings of fire hearths that they were finding. And these fire hearths were, I think there was four of them all together.
Yeah.
And they were separated. Go ahead.
I was just going to pause you there and let's talk about it with an image up.
Okay,
of the
perfect.
Fire hearths.
Yeah,
so
we'll
go to the hearth image first. So let's skip over this. We'll come back to that in a minute.
That's perfect. So you see the hearth imagery there in the middle, and they were finding these hearth features, but then they were finding all these other little features around that middle hearth. And so this was what was so interesting to them and what they were really perplexed about, because no one had really seen something like this before. And so they were looking at all these little holes, you can see all the little smaller features around
like
that main hearth feature.
The largest circle in the center, and then you have sort of these middle-sized ones that are a little bit deeper, and then you have the much
smaller ones.
And like you said, there was groupings of these. So there was four different areas on the site that had groupings like this.
Yeah.
So that's a big site.
And so they were coming back and saying, oh, we're finding all this plant, plant material, flora, within the site. And it's so interesting. And at that point, they didn't know what these, you know, were used for or what was going on here, because they didn't really have the big picture. But now we have the big picture. And so we can now report back that those big hearth features in the middle were used to make the charcoal. So they were kind of like these pits where they would burn a lot of different wood.
A lot of different wood, sticks and brush.
Species of wood, which I can't remember. Can you remember what it was? But anyway, it doesn't matter.
It was things that were local to the area at the time. So there was some pines, different pines and conifers and things like that. And then also smaller brush, kind of more brushier.
Which was so interesting that they were able to kind of figure out what those were that was being burned. But they would burn it down into charcoal. And then they would use this charcoal to bring the charcoal into these roasting pits. And so that's what those medium-sized pits are that you see next to the larger fire hearth, are roasting pits. And these are pits that were basically, the charcoal was put down first, and then they would put a layer of dirt over the charcoal, and then they would put a layer of green grasses and other plant material, and then they would put the food that they were roasting on the top of that. And so that is fascinating. And it was just basically an oven. We don't know really what temperatures these were at or how long they roasted the food, but we know that they were roasting food in these medium-sized little ovens.
Right. These like small little ovens that would have had sort of like your kind of dinner packet of food. Like I would think of like when you go camping and then you like heat up your little packet of food that you bought at REI. But because the way they describe it is they might have even had it in sort of a wet pouch of leather or of some other material that they then sandwiched in between leaves and brush, and then charcoal was on the bottom and the top, and they put the dirt over. And we know so many places where they have these below ground ovens that they create, but in a lot of places the remnants that we have usually contain rocks that are lining the pit, and those rocks, once you've had a fire in there, you put charcoal in, they really hold that heat. So we don't know exactly, like you said, how well, how quickly, or what they were trying to do. But Carl Davis, who was writing a summary in his book, I think based on the report that Steve Auber did and some of the writing that Les Davis did on this, is that some of the seed species would pop almost like popcorn, and they would dry out, and they could then grind them and later turn them into some sort of like oatmeal that you could eat, or cream of wheat or something,
it was also
once it had been heated and charred, you could also just store it longer. So you could cook a whole bunch of it and then, use it later. So fascinating. And then the smallest holes, I believe they think were possibly posts where they were maybe drying other resources. There was post holes around.
So those are post holes.
So we don't get a sense yet that there was a structure that was over these, that they were in it. It seemed to be a big open space where they estimate, more than 100 people might have gathered and used these the open braziers to make the charcoal and then cook in these little ovens around it. And then, they came back multiple times to this place. So this wasn't a year-round occupation.
Yeah.
I think Steve Auberg's looking at the species of flora that they got. So Chenopodium being one of them, and that's lamb's quarters, some people know it as, or goosefoot, is that right?
Yeah, so it's the goosefoot or the lamb's quarters.
And then a lot of prickly pear cactus. Mm-hmm. And so those seeds, and probably also the pads, so they're cooking and they're roasting these seeds, and those would be late summer, early fall, harvest time is what they're thinking. This would have been the time they were collecting and cooking these plants. So 90% of the plant resources recovered were Chenopodium or prickly pear, but there were other taxa in there. I think they mentioned also chokecherry, sunflower, wild rose, and other species just in lesser quantities. And I don't know if that's because this was what they preferred or just was available, because we know those other species were used in places. But they were able to take soil from these areas that had all these charcoal stains, the areas that were burned, and then they do flotation. Have you ever done flotation?
I've done a lot of flotation.
Have you? I have too, back in the day.
Back in the day. Like, that's been like 30 years ago.
All right, tell the people. Tell the people what flotation is like.
So basically, you know, out at the site, you put the soil into Ziploc bags and you transport it back to a lab. Well, some people do flotation on site, but I, you know, when I worked with Dr. Tom Roll, we a lot of times would decide which areas we wanted to sample for the flotation.
Absolutely.
And we would take them back to the lab and we'd set up this kind of these two different tubs of water, and we would float, we would put the soil in and the plant remains and the plant materials would float up to the top.
Especially if they had been burned and charred. Exactly.
And then you skim it off. Yeah. And then you hire an ethnobotanist like Steve Auberg to analyze what the plant remains are and what is remaining of the plant species from sites like this one. And so oftentimes you do that with every single site and to find out what was going on plant wise. But this site, I think it was, they probably did much more intense.
I think they did more intense, more samples because there were so many burned features that potentially had material. And I think that's where they could get at the larger ones really just had charcoal. They didn't look like they were cooking edible seeds in there, you know, and then it was in the smaller, deeper pits that were ovens. That's where they were getting the mix of other things.
Yeah.
So fascinating. I know they also recovered pollen from there. I did the same thing for my master's thesis.
I was going to say, so when you did flotation, was it out at the site?
I went over to Morocco after a field season that my advisor had, Nancy Banco, who was working on a medieval site in Morocco, and they had taken soil samples, and I had to do flotation.
Yeah.
And there was the heavy fraction that went to the bottom.
Yeah.
And this was an Iron Age site, so there was lots of residue from smelting iron and other interesting things, sort of micro, you know, artifacts that came out of the heavy fraction and the light fraction. It was amazing. These seeds were so well preserved. And then I went and I did, once I dried them all, then I shipped them from Morocco all the way back to, and the only box someone could give me was a Heineken box. And it was awful to walk through the streets of Morocco as a woman by myself, carrying a Heineken box, trying to quickly get it wrapped in brown paper so I could get it shipped.
It
showed back up at George Washington University. I then, I went and I did an internship at the University of Pennsylvania University Museum. They have an applied sciences program there. And I did an internship with Naomi Miller and she taught me how to do paleoethnobotany.
Oh, cool.
So I did the seed identification.
You did it. Wow.
Yeah. And it was terrifying because it was like, I'm doing real science for the first time and I don't want to mess up.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I went through each and every sample and reported on that. And it was very exciting to see what you could learn, what you could recover, because this wasn't a technique that they were using way back in the day,
now
that we can recover. So I know people were especially excited about Barton Gold's too, because it was the first time it wasn't all about bison bone and big stone points.
Yeah.
You know, it gave you a window into likely what women's work was yielding.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, I'm sure, just women who were gathering,
but
we know that from other ethnographic resources, women do a lot of gathering. And there was also small game at the site. So no bison, but we do have other mammals that show up that were cooked and eaten.
Lots of deer, which
absolutely
makes sense, because that's, you know, what people
both
hunt
mule deer and
today there in the Madison County. Right. That's true.
And then smaller game. So both cottontails and jackrabbits and porcupine. So snares, nets, lots of other ways. I mean, I was almost like, well, maybe this was like a woman's camp and the men were doing something else.
I know, you know, and it's hard to, say, you know, if this was a woman's camp, but you know, 9,000 years ago, that's a long time ago. What were the gender roles? We have no idea.
We have no idea.
No idea what was going on. So it could have been either or, but I like to think, you know, that this is a little bit more of a insight into what women did, you know, historically within these places as well.
And to see such a big site, so many people gathering and so many people doing the same process.
Yeah,
it must have been something that worked. And it just makes you wonder what more is out there. We didn't expect to find this. So a couple of things. One thing is we know Steve Armstrong, who was a master's student at University of Montana. He knew about the site. I don't know if he worked there, but his master's thesis was to try to replicate these ovens and see if he could cook something and find out anything about the cooking temperatures and all of that. Mm-hmm. And I think the trials that he did were not completely successful in terms of cooking the seeds the way they maybe thought they were, but they got close enough to feel that they had learned a lot about how they operated.
That's great. And we've mentioned this before on podcasts that experimental archaeology is so important to better understand what is happening at these places.
Right.
So, and just to kind of go back a little bit and talk about, these plants that they were finding and kind of what they were, you know, they just weren't eating this material. They were using these plants for so many other things too.
Right.
And so they were using that lamb's quarters as also for salves. They were using it in teas. They would most likely use it in teas. And
I mean, there were some leafy greens you could eat, but as you said, there was probably all these other things we know historically people were using them for.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to think that they weren't also making salves or teas.
Yeah. And all those things were probably, they were probably processing these plants and making all this on site.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see the pop seeds that they ground into that coarse meal that you were talking about, but we can kind of extrapolate that they were doing a lot of this other stuff as well. So that's fascinating to me.
It is.
Yeah.
And there's probably so much more going on that we even know.
Yeah.
But we should take a look at the stone tools that are found at Barton Gulch this period, this later Paleo Indian period, that are different from classic Clovis and Folsom. So let's put that up for anyone who's not totally familiar with what those look like. So there we have Clovis points off on the left-hand side where they're very large points that would have been hafted to basically a spear that you could probably throw with an atlatl.
Yeah.
So no bows and arrows at this point. And these points are big. They can be heavy, but they're very aerodynamic. You can see how symmetrical they are. And then they have those channel flakes, those flutes taken off of the bottom where you can see the black lines showing where they thinned it probably to facilitate it being hafted into the shaft of the spear. Exactly. And Clovis doesn't last all that long. You know, we have it, these points showing up, not just in Montana, but in many, many sites across North America and I think down into Central America. And then we get into the next early Paleo-Indian period we call Folsom, because we have some sites where it's a huge bison kill and all the points are Folsom points. So Folsom points tend to be not as long as large overall, but the flute, the channel flake taken off is bigger. Mm-hmm. It covers a larger proportion of the body of the point. And I think these were very effective tools, but from what flint knappers tell us, both Clovis points and Folsom points are really, really hard to make. They're the hardest ones to make.
Yeah.
Thinning them, taking those flakes off the base, it's hard not to have it break. They're beautiful. They're kind of like the high prize in the Paleo-Indian period. When you find one, it's always a wow moment.
Yeah, and it shows, you know, the oldest time period. We have some pre-Clovis things we're going into now too, but that when if you see a Clovis point, you know this is probably one of the oldest sites in Montana or in this part of the country.
Absolutely, the stone tool complexes we see at sites that are older than Clovis are not super impressive.
No,
like they have points, they have scrapers, like they have all the things, you know, but they're not these incredible sort of sophisticated and really big game hunting weapons, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting because they were hunting some big game or at least scavenging them. But this is a purely American invention. You know, this wasn't, you don't find it in Siberia where those ancestral populations came across. They look similar to some of the nicest points we find, the Salutrian points that we find in France, along the coast of France and into Spain. But those are 5,000 years older, and we don't have any evidence of people coming across. So this was independent American invention by people that had migrated to these continents, to North and South America, had been living there for thousands of years, likely. And this was what they did for a couple thousand years. They made these really impressive points. And then they stopped taking those flutes out of the bottom. So what we see all the way off to the right is the Alder Complex and Hell Gap. I've also heard that call Agate Basin, that larger mm-hmm. one. So the one on the left-hand side of the blue square, those are the ones that are most associated with the Barton Gulch site. Okay. So you can see they're still long. They have this kind of lanceolate shape, but they their bottom is a little bit more rounded, whereas the ones to the right of them, Hell Gap, are usually a little bit more stunted at the bottom, and they're not quite as long.
Yeah.
So that's what I think they must have found some of yeah. in the area, yeah. aside from evidence of stone tool making.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
it wasn't the main activity that was going on at this site. They weren't spending a lot of time making those points to hunt, and they weren't hunting big game there. Probably what they were doing was using other methods, maybe some atlatls, but probably snares and nets and other things and traps to catch smaller game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So talk about, you've talked a little bit about this, but this was not a long-term occupation. They weren't living here year after year after year. It was kind of a
more seasonal.
More seasonal. So can you talk a little bit more about
right.
that?
I think from what we see in just the sites that we have from these periods is that they tend to give us plant information and information from animal remains that'll tell us what time of year people might have been there. So at yeah. bison kill sites, they tended to be in the fall and sometimes in the early winter. And so this is a much different time of the year. So the picture that emerges is a seasonal round, much in the way that animals probably would have made seasonal rounds during this time period. We're after the period of the Younger Dryas, so things are starting to warm, and there's a proliferation of plant species in the area. So we're not in the Ice Age, and we're not in severe drought. And this area around Barton Gulch looked to be a pretty lush area. So people probably came back. There's water there that would have attracted game. There's plants they knew when they would be ripening, when they could collect the seeds. And then they were probably well aware of what game was available. And then maybe they moved on later to go after large bison migrations. Mm-hmm. They probably knew where they'd likely be, and then they'd store up on that through the winter, something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's so much more.
It was part of that round. It was
exactly.
part of that where they would go at a certain time of year and harvest these plants and do what they did, and then they'd move on. And then
they'd
yeah.
often come back to
yeah.
these. And we see that in later periods where people do leave these stone circles that are associated with, you know, lodges and you know, teepees, whatever you want to call them, that they would come back to these places over and over. So it seems likely that idea of those seasonal rounds, especially because we're on the plains
yeah.
and northern plains,
yeah.
Not a lot of areas where you could hunker down and find resources all year round. Some places on California and on the Pacific coast, there were salmon runs, acorn harvests, once people could leach things out of acorns so you could eat them, all this stuff where you didn't have to move as a hunter-gatherer. You could stay in one place, and through the year, different things would become available. And so you could have sedentary foragers, which is not something we usually think about, yeah. but not in Montana.
Yeah.
So yeah.
yeah.
So this is giving us though a big piece of the picture.
Right.
And you'll notice that we're not showing any of the Barton
we are not.
Artifacts today. So we should talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, because that is interesting as well. Why we are not showing these artifacts? Because at the beginning, we talked about how these artifacts are within the Museum of the Rockies collection, but we are not showing them. So I'll let you kind of start off with that, Nancy.
Right. We had this idea to talk about Barton Gulch because we're doing this collaboration with the Museum of the Rockies, and we were really excited about it. And then we realized that just as late as December in 2023, there has been new legislation to update a very important law that was originally passed in 1990. So that's NAGPRA, or the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. And that's an act you and I are both very familiar with. Mm-hmm. Super important legislation that for the first time was developed with both tribal input, the input of anthropologists, archaeologists, and government legislators. And after a long time, people came together and realized the tribes for decades had been upset that so many of their ancestral remains, human remains, the grave goods that might have been associated with burials, as well as other important objects to the tribes, were in museum collections. Things were on display that shouldn't have been seen by people, and ancestors' spirits were not able to rest, very upsetting because they're in this unfamiliar place. They had either been taken from graves or taken directly from battlefields, yeah, or dug up from graves that were as young as 50 years old. So there, yeah, weren't laws, great laws, protecting graves and important cultural items until NAGPRA was passed in 1990. And that only applied to items that came from federal lands, mm-hmm, or to collections that were in museums that accepted federal money. So talk a little, right, bit about that.
Yeah, yeah. And we talked a lot about this on a podcast we did with Chip Caldwell.
Yes.
And that he wrote a book called Plundered Skulls and Stolen Spirits, which I have right here. So I'll put it. And so we really talked about the reasoning behind NAGPRA, but also collections and some of the issues kind of surrounding those. So if you want to go back to that previous podcast, I highly recommend it. It was a great talk with Chip Caldwell.
And
it really
amazing.
Gives yeah. some of this background information, not as much on NAGPRA, but on why laws like NAGPRA are passed and why the strengthening of the NAGPRA law happened. And this just came into effect January 12th of 2024. And so museums are kind of better understanding that and kind of processing through this, the tightening up of this law, or kind of the.
So what people have realized since 1990 is that NAGPRA isn't a perfect law. Mm-hmm. No laws are perfect, but one of the things that government often does is they pass good and well-meaning legislation, and there isn't really a lot of funding behind it. And one of the biggest glaring examples of that is that in 66 when we had NEPA and that passed, we had states set up historic preservation offices. Mm-hmm. So all the states had an office that dealt with historic and archaeological sites and surveyed and recorded and kept information. And you had people hired that were representative that could speak to if a road was being built or something was being built, if this was a historically significant site that was going to be in the way, then there was a way to either move the project, change the project, or try to recover information if there was no way to do that. So fast forward to 1990, that passes, and now the tribes as sovereign nations have to come up with their own tribal historic preservation offices, but there really isn't well-funded. And they are learning about everything that would be required so that they can consult when a site might be damaged by work that might be going on in a national park or a roadway that has federal funds or anything. And letters are just being sent to them, and they don't have the resources and the time to respond to all of them. Also, trying to get all of the information from museums about everything that's in their collection that might be relevant to, because a lot of tribes like the Crow and the Hidatsa share a history. If you go back a certain amount of time, their languages still show that close connection and how long ago that they may have been one tribe that separated into others. So what that means is you often have multiple tribes that will have a claim on a site, mm-hmm. on remains, if it's far enough back at a certain time period. And that's totally legitimate. Anthropologists understand this. This isn't something that's disagreed upon. But trying to get all of those people together and get permissions. So lots of issues with NAGPRA. This most recent round where they strengthened it under Deb Haaland, Department of the Interior, yeah. Secretary, which is amazing, is that they've really done a couple of things that are important. One is that they've strengthened the value of the knowledge that comes from tribes through oral histories, their geographic locations, their understanding of their own ancestral history, so that it is not considered of lesser value than other scientific data that was privileged in earlier cases like the Kennewick Man, mm-hmm. which ended up being reversed and that skeleton was repatriated to the Colville tribe. But originally, those things weren't really considered equal, and collections weren't considered necessarily to show a cultural affiliation if they went back to this Paleo-Indian period, right. like the Anzac way.
Like 9,000 years ago or exactly. 12,000 years ago.
And so yeah. they were considered to be too old to be culturally mm-hmm. affiliated. But interestingly enough, in several cases where they've had skeletal remains, mm-hmm. Anzac Boy, Spirit Cave in Nevada, Kennewick Man, and there's a couple others, in each case, when the tribes have provided DNA, who are geographically closest and feel that they have the strongest claim because they also have ancestral stories, the DNA comes back showing that mm-hmm. those tribes are indeed the closest relations. Yeah. And then these 9,000, 10,000-year-old ancestors are repatriated and reburied. So it's really changed how we think about time and cultural affiliation, and mm-hmm. rightly so. Mm-hmm. So the second important thing that's happened is they're calling out those museums who haven't really gotten all their inventory together and documented, and they've given them 5 years. So that's it. By 2029, they have to have it done. So yeah. that the tribes now also have the right to say whether any items, and this is the one that's pertaining to us here, mm-hmm. were any items that they may be affiliated with, whether people are allowed to do scientific research with mm-hmm. it. So you can't just do destructive analysis on human remains yeah. or any other artifacts without the permission of the tribes. And you can't display them and just say an archaeological version or museum version interpretation yeah. of the artifacts, again, without consultation. So it really promotes this much more collaborative path going forward, that yeah. really everything has to be done with the tribe's input and blessing in order for it to be ethical and legal. And I think ethically, so many of us have already moved in that direction, yeah. but this really strengthens their cases across the board.
Yeah.
Really important.
Right. And we wholeheartedly
yes,
support this because I know what it is, especially today. But so for us, it gave us yes. the great opportunity when we weren't able to show the artifacts yes. to be able to talk about this. So yes. I think it's great. And I love it.
It is. And we're fine yeah. with that. Yeah. There's enough information out there and we know the artifacts are safe here. And we yeah. know eventually down the line, there will be time for those discussions to happen yeah. so that the museum would either consider repatriation or consider doing a collaborative display of right. these items for the research. So I think all of those things are so important going forward because we get a more complete picture and understanding. And we've right. seen over and over how important that is.
Right.
So yeah, so we're all for it. And
yes.
the new rules are a good way forward.
Yes, exactly.
And then I just want to follow up with anyone who's interested in learning more about Barton Gulch. We want to point you back towards this book that we mentioned earlier, 600 Generations. So this is an archaeological history of Montana that was published in 2020. And the book is by Carl Davis, who we love. We know him through the Montana Archaeological Society. And he has been...
And we've also done a podcast with him.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
you
that's
look
right.
That up. Yep. He's fantastic. Yeah. I think when the book came out.
Yeah, when the book came out. So it's one of the older... It's an oldie but a good, but a goodie.
Yes, an oldie but a goodie. Yeah. But he worked as a National Forest archaeologist in both Oregon and Montana for 35 years. He's retired now, but... He wrote this in retirement, so yeah. I don't know if he's really retired.
Probably not.
But I can't say enough about this book. It is written for a popular audience, and it has won 2 awards because it's so good.
So
excited when I went to find it again out for sale. They now have the award-winning stamp on the front. He was awarded the best popular book by the Society for American Archaeology in 2020. That was a huge honor, as well as for the High Plains Book Award for the best science book. And it's because it tackles some really important deep histories. He doesn't skimp on the science, but he writes about it so beautifully and in such an accessible way.
Right. Right. And it's just so many, he writes about so many archaeological sites like the Barton Gulch site that are so significantly important and you don't hear about it on a daily basis. So it's good to dive into this and really read through it.
Great pictures, great sketches, great drawings by Eric Carlson. So there's a lot to recommend the book.
The artist Eric Carlson did this beautiful drawing on the front, illustration on the front, but then throughout the whole book, there's great illustrations as well.
He brings to life how the sites would have been used by people, because really we're ultimately about learning about the people.
Pictograph cave right there.
There you go. There you
I just opened it right up to that.
A good one on there. And also Carl Davis had mentioned in there, which I had forgotten about, that there was a 1993 video made by the Museum of the Rockies with Les Davis, so the excavator of the site, and it's entitled People of the Hearth, Paleo-Indians of the Northern Rockies, and that you can just plug into YouTube, People of the Hearth, and up will come a half an hour video. And so that's wonderful. You can actually see the site and you can see archaeologists doing the work and you can hear Les Davis talking about what they found out. So that's a really good resource.
Well, we are kind of coming and our time, Nancy and Ashley and Sophie.
And Sophie,
Sophie finally went to sleep. So I'm so glad for all of you listeners out there that you were able to join us today, either on our podcast app or on YouTube. We're so glad to be able to have you here with us. If you love this podcast, please tell a friend and make sure to subscribe or hit that follow button so it shows up in your podcast feed each week, and leave a review for us. Leave a review either on Apple Podcasts or on YouTube. You can
ask a question.
Interact with us. We love it. So thanks for listening to our podcast and YouTube videocast today, and we hope you can join us again to find out more about the dirt on the past. And a big thank you to the Museum of the Rockies. Thanks, Ashley.
Yay, Ashley. Here she comes. Yay. Yay. Oh, Sophie wants to say hi too. Awesome.
And all the help that we get from the Museum of the Rockies. Thanks to Chelsea Hogan, Melissa Dawn, Ashley Hall, of course, and Michael Fox. And thanks to Lawson Alegria for mixing our music. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.